Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akio, and if you're interested in blogging, knowledge sharing, and a little bit of imposter syndrome, then this episode is for you. Joining me today is Andrew Duthie. He's a senior technical architect at Xebia US, so he's actually calling in, and we had a lot of fun. I'll put all his socials in the description below, check him out, and with that being said, enjoy the episode. Beyond
coding. So I've been blogging since like 2004.
Okay.
So, you know, almost 20 years now.
Yeah.
And I started off on .txt, which was Scott Watermask actually put that together. And then that later rolled into something that was hosted as weblogs.asp.net.
Okay.
And kind of went from there. And because I was working at Microsoft, because I'm just that kind of person and that kind of personality, I decided I wanted to write my own blog on a .NET CMS that I could customize to my liking.
Okay.
And there's nothing wrong with that per se. It's just that the downside, and this is like, I don't think this is specific to .NET. I don't think this is specific to Orchard CMS, which was the platform I chose. But the downside to taking a CMS and customizing it by just going in and changing up the code when it's open source is that then you own it.
Yep.
Right. That every time that an update comes out, you've got the risk of something breaks. Right. And you've got to go in and fix it. And it becomes a matter of like, okay, do I want to write and maintain blog software or do I want to blog?
Exactly. Right? What do you want to do here?
And that's the reason that my blog is on WordPress now, because I'd rather blog. Now, the sad thing is that I've not been very good about keeping that up to date of late, because blogging is also a lot of work. And sometimes you make choices about priorities in your life, and my priority of late has been more family, and like I'm gonna have work be work, and there are things that I'll do in terms of content creation, but you know, I'm working on trying to get a little more back into blogging, because I think blogging has come somewhat out of favor as a way of sharing content. I think that, at least for me, can't speak for everybody else, but I feel like social media took away some of the impetus.
Okay.
Right. So for me, blogging was a way for me to both express my ideas, but also to share things that I had either recently done that I thought were cool or interesting, or that other people could learn from. Or in some cases, like, this thing really tripped me up and I just fixed it, so I'm going to write about that.
Yeah.
And a good example of that is I have a post up on my blog about, I think it's VirtualBox. It was like one of the virtual machine software and some setting that I needed to change to get some specific scenario to work. And I don't even like remember the details of it myself, but it is literally the most read and commented post on my entire blog, because that problem exists to this day.
Yeah.
And people are still searching for it and finding my blog post, and it's still fixing their problem.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
How do you, it's like this thing I just kind of threw out there because, well, I ran into this, maybe it'll help somebody else.
Yeah.
And like years later, people are still finding it helpful. It's like, it's super gratifying, but B, it's like, why isn't it a programming thing? It's like the fact that I'm a programmer geek. My whole life has been teaching programmers, and that's not what I did in this post, but you know, that's neither here nor there. It's just funny how those things work out. But a lot of times, like those things that you would normally do like a short blog post, you might just throw that out on social media, right? Like throw out a tweet that says, hey, if you run into this, blah, 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 you know, go to this link, right? Because, and again, I can't speak for others, but at least for me, there's almost like a biological impulse or a brain impulse that's like, you need to share this.
Mm.
And if I can satisfy that impulse in the moment with a tweet that takes 30 seconds,
yeah,
right? Even if it's not like, I would not say for a moment that a tweet is as good as or equivalent to a blog post, but it's a whole lot faster and easier. Yeah. I mean, like back to the topic of podcasting and such is that if you reduce the friction, right? Are you going to go for the low friction option or are you going to go for the high friction option?
Exactly.
Right. And I've got enough blog posts that are in draft status that I started and haven't finished that I think the answer is pretty clear for me.
Yeah. But I think if we talk about social media, I don't know if it has the same findability that blog posts have, which is why probably I think blog posts are still king, right? I mean, blog posts, and I kind of put newsletters under the same avenue because I feel like newsletters are up and coming. It is like a podcast because it has a schedule and a certain cadence to it. You can have certain topics or certain themes within a certain month, and people get digested content frequently or semi-frequently, depending on your cadence. And you can still find them just as good as blog posts are. Now, for those quick thoughts, for those quick learnings, and probably for some social media followers, you have social media. And I think those are more fast food related content. They can still refer to the blog posts or the newsletters, but I think those are more so for outreach, for reaching the correct audience and then directing them to where the source of information is. At least that's where I see the value of social media when it comes to knowledge sharing in that aspect. I don't think it's a platform in and of its own. I think it's more so an avenue and an insight into where the source actually is.
Yeah. And I think 100%, I think that you're absolutely right that blogs haven't lost their value in terms of what they can do.
Yeah.
I think that, and I think like the point of findability is really key.
Yeah.
Right. The fact that somebody is still finding my blog post from years ago, all this time later,
that's
I think
crazy.
Only highlights that, right? Yeah. You tweet something and it vanishes, right? Unless, of course, it goes viral, usually for all the wrong reasons.
But then still it vanishes.
Well, then you wish it would vanish sooner.
Sure.
But that doesn't diminish the value of the blog post versus social media. Yeah. I think the point that I was kind of getting at is more that when the impetus is I need to share some knowledge, and you can kind of scratch that itch enough with social media, it can make it harder to carve out the time and the effort to go deeper into the topic on the blog.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know, I mean, that may be more my personality quirk and might not affect other people, but I do, I do see, I think less kind of, I don't know, how do I want to describe this? So I have to kind of think this through from an observer bias standpoint, right? That there was a period of time when I was deeply involved in the .NET blogosphere.
Yeah.
Right. And so my experience at that time was colored by the number of people that I was seeing at conferences, talking to regularly, et cetera. And so my perception now is that there's less of a kind of vibrant blog community, but I'm also not as deeply in the .NET world as I was.
I'm
not blogging
sense.
As often. So it could well be that my observations are colored by where I am in my particular content creation mode. So I'm not going to make any.
Just for me, blogging, and I still think it holds true because back then, exactly as you mentioned, when you've solved the problem, you want to share that in a certain way. And I still think more long form content, more so a blog post than a tweet, for example, or a LinkedIn post, is still the medium to do so because you want to explain your context, your scenario, what you encountered. You want to share some code maybe now and then or give some examples or share some drawings. I feel like the blog is still the right avenue for that. And then lately, one of my colleagues was like, okay, I've always been a front-end engineer. I was a designer by trade initially, and then I learned more front-end concepts. And now he's trying to pick up more back-end technologies. So then... Mm-hmm. Blogging for him is a way to also structure his thoughts and it helps him throughout the learning journey. And he's posting small articles of stuff that he's learned. And it's, he says it's for himself, obviously, but he also wants to share his journey throughout there. And I thought that was a really interesting avenue. If you want to pick up a new topic, structure your thoughts, write them down, and you can keep those notes for yourself. But what you can also do is publicize them and get feedback, and maybe people can help you, and it can accelerate the process, and it can help others. I think that's a real neat win-win that you can also do with blogging.
Yeah. And the thing is that the internet's a really big place.
Yeah.
So anytime you have a problem or anytime you're learning something, the chances are absolutely non-zero that there's going to be at least one other person out there who is learning that thing or who has that problem. And so, I am a huge advocate of doing that. I think that writing down your thoughts, like the two ways that I think are best to either learn or cement your learning are writing or teaching. Hmm. Right. So writing is essentially a form of teaching, but I think that getting in front of, like, one of the things that I think really kicked my career into high gear when I got started in the IT world. And I spent my first 6 years out of college after I graduated. I was a music and theater major.
Yeah.
And I went to school a few hours south of Washington, D.C., got graduated, had no idea what I was going to do. So I had some connections in the D.C. theater scene, and I just got work doing technical theater, which I did for about 6 years.
Yeah.
Lots of fun, great parties, does not pay squat. And as you'd imagine, Washington, D.C. is not a cheap place to live. So making no money and living in Washington, D.C. is not a fantastic combination,
exactly,
to say the least. So I ended up getting into software. And one of the things that really made it possible for me to make that transition quickly was I got into a job where I was sitting with the top two developers in the company I was working for, who were great mentors and teachers. And one of them was also a big fan of user groups.
Okay.
And so he started getting me going to the local user group communities in the DC area. And before I knew it, I was actually speaking at user groups, because like once you start learning things, you can share them, even if you don't know much. And that's one of the things that, like, I would say anybody who's watching this, who's relatively new, don't think you don't have anything to teach or share, right? Because it doesn't matter if you don't know a lot, you already know something that somebody else doesn't, right? And you can share that and teach it. And in sharing that and teaching it, you get to meet people, you get to know people who, you know, have different backgrounds than you do, who may know different technologies or who may have different answers than you have. And those connections are great on a personal level. And they're also great in terms of, you know, pushing your career forward, right? You're pushing yourself in terms of growing, you know, in presenting and kind of formulating your ideas through presenting them. And that's, you know, again, that gets back to the blogging aspect, right? Is forcing yourself to formulate your ideas in a way that is consumable for someone else is helpful in organizing those ideas and effectively cementing them more strongly in your brain. The other piece, and I'm sure if you've been blogging for any length of time, you've encountered this, just always cracks me up, is anytime I'm searching for something and in the search results, one of my blog posts comes up and I'm like, I forgot that I actually solved this before and blogged about it.
That's hilarious. I don't think many people have that.
I've had it more than once.
And really?
It's like either that speaks to a level of forgetfulness on my part, which is entirely possible. But it's kind of a very surreal scenario to find your own blog post when you're searching for a solution to something. Oh yeah, I did run into that before, and
that's pretty funny.
And I fixed it. Yeah. Hopefully, it doesn't happen twice with the exact same blog post. That would be kind of sad, I think.
Yeah, I mean, from my personal experience, like I've never actually taken that step to write a blog post. Like I like writing technical documentation. It's more so for the context and the organization, or just for context for my future self or the people that come after me. Like I like writing those, but I've never taken the time to dive into a topic and write a blog post about a certain unknown thing or learning I've had. Like I like more so the avenue of video content creation or doing podcasts to share perspectives or even standing on stage, which is something I want to do more of. Mm-hmm. But for me, blogging is just not, I don't know, maybe it's just not my thing. I've just never done it. And I don't know exactly where that comes from. I'm not a big reader. People listening in that have listened to a few episodes might know that. I'm not a reader almost at all. So that might have something to do with it. But I really admire people that do blog. Because obviously, if I'm looking for something, I have a certain problem and someone has solved it, I might pop into their blogs. I have had colleagues who blog and they're in the kind of same technology space that I am in. And I've seen their blogs. I've come across their blogs when I'm searching for stuff. So I do admire that. I've just never taken that step. I just realized that. That's weird.
I think there's something to the idea that, you know, that people have, you know, people are wired differently.
Yeah.
Right. And we also, I think we all definitely have our individual communication styles. And I think that, you know, it seems perfectly natural to me that people have preferred ways of sharing knowledge. And there are some people who aren't interested in sharing knowledge, and that's fine. Like I would definitely not want somebody to come away from this podcast thinking, gosh, if I'm not blogging or I'm not doing podcasting or if I'm not doing video content, I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah.
Because that's not at all the message.
Like, exactly.
You know, I think that, I think that folks like you, folks like me, there's a certain kind of built-in impetus, you know, and I think about like one of my hobbies is I play Ultimate Frisbee.
Okay.
Which given
that's awesome.
It's probably a little clear that I'm not the youngest person in the world. But it's a sport I picked up. It's a sport I picked up about 7 or 8 years ago when my oldest son, who's now 20, was in middle school.
Okay.
And he wanted to go because our youth minister at church was running Ultimate Frisbee and one of his friends was playing and he wanted to go play with his friend.
Yeah.
And I ended up loving it. I chaperone every Saturday at our church. And then I'm actually playing in 3 leagues right now, which is kind of insane.
Wow. That's
but
awesome.
One of the things that I was talking with somebody last night about, I had a game and I'm a captain on this particular league and one of the players on my team, and we're just in our second game, so haven't had a chance to get to know everybody really well, just a very quiet person. And I asked him, you know, how are you doing? Is everything okay? I said, you seem like you're a fairly quiet, you know, and he said, oh, I'm fine. No, you know, everything's all right. And I said, all right. And I said, you know, I just kind of observed that, like, I'm a verbal processor. So like, as we're going through the game, I'm talking.
Okay.
So for me, it's perfectly natural that the way that I would process, you know, any technology stuff is, you know, make a video or do a podcast or, you know, or blog.
Yeah.
I've written a number of books, which again, like for people who are early in their career, yes, you should write a book. Be prepared. It's a painful process. And
I'm not going to do that.
books are somewhat like, I would describe them a little bit like my theater days in that you're not going to like a technology book unless it's an absolute breakout or something like, you know, using Windows, like those books that the average user would use.
Yeah.
But like programming books, you're not going to make bank on a programming book.
No.
But it can be a career pivot. So like for people who are inclined and have the discipline to get through that process, you know, I mean, it's effectively how I got my foot in the door at Microsoft.
Okay.
Right. Is I through again, the same guy who got me involved in the user group community,
yeah,
happened to know a book agent. And I literally asked him, do you know anybody who might know somebody? Or I guess he put me in touch with the agent. I went to the agent and said, do you know anybody who's working on a book like one of the old Rocks books where there were 20 authors each doing one chapter? Mm. I was like, I've learned enough that I could probably write a chapter about something.
Yeah.
Right. And which was pretty arrogant of me at the time, since I was still like within the first couple of years of my, but I was speaking at user groups. I had actually, I think, I don't know if I had already started writing some magazine articles at the time, but like I was getting connected into some of those publishing worlds.
Yeah.
And I thought like a chapter is not that bad. Right. It's, you know, 30, 40 pages.
Oh, that's more than I thought. Okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it depends on the book, but yeah. Like those Rocks books were, you know, I mean, they're like bricks. They were okay. Huge. But I thought, you know, this is manageable. And so I reached out to this guy and he's like, no, I don't have any projects going on, but why don't we work on a proposal?
Okay.
And so I thought, well, nobody's going to ever let me write a book, but this could be an interesting exercise
sure.
to go through, right? I can learn a lot by writing a book proposal.
Yeah.
And there's no real danger because nobody's going to let somebody like me who's this new in my career write a book.
Yeah. And then it happened.
I'm not going to go into the long detail. There was a fairly lengthy process, but at the end of that fairly lengthy process, Microsoft Press said, yes, let's write this book. And at which point, like, what?
Yeah.
That was not supposed to happen. That's not what it is. Now I have to write a book. Right.
That's hilarious.
And it's funny because it's like, That was not in the plan for me at all, like writing a book. But it ended up happening. Yeah. And I, you know, I'd love to say it was a great book. It was a decent book. I'm happy with it long term. It helped put a down payment on my house. So that was kind of nice.
Yeah.
But one of the things I did there is like, you know, and again, like to kind of offer some advice to folks who may be earlier in their career, be prepared to leverage the experience and knowledge of other people, right? So in that case, the book that I was writing was titled Visual InterDev 6 Enterprise Developers Workshop.
Okay.
If there's a Microsoft Press title that ever was, that's it. Like that was really long.
Yeah.
But the idea was that at the time, Visual InterDev, which for those who may not remembered or be familiar with, it was kind of a visual way of building classic ASP applications. This is pre-ASP.NET, pre-.NET. And the idea was it had kind of come into its own a little bit. And so I was making the case that it was a suitable tool for building enterprise applications.
Yeah.
And I wanted the book to cover not just the tool itself, but also various aspects of enterprise application development that were necessary. So things like, you know, robust security,
yeah.
queuing, you know, transaction management, things like that. And those things were definitely outside my wheelhouse at the time.
Okay.
So I found four people at the company I worked for at the time who had relevant expertise.
Okay.
And I pulled them in to write chapters on those topics.
Perfect.
That ends up being a lot of work in a sense, because unlike the Rocks books, it ended up being in some sense a little bit like that. But the Rocks books were really literally just an author per chapter, and
yeah.
they were very clear about that. They had like the Brady Bunch picture collage on the front of the books. So in this case, though, Microsoft Press wanted the book in one voice,
yeah,
which meant I would get the chapter from each of the individual authors, kind of massage it into my voice,
yeah.
send it to Microsoft Press. They'd send me edits. I'd send it back to the author, and you know, usually about three cycles of that per chapter.
Wow.
So it ends up being a lot of overhead, but it was absolutely essential to being able to get the project done.
Yeah.
Because I could not have done those chapters without the assistance of my co-authors.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I like that. Like this started out as an opportunity, actually, or you wanted something, you didn't even get it, but you got the opportunity to do something else.
Yeah.
And instead of being like, oh, this is not what I wanted, you're like, let's try this out, right? Because a lot of things that'll come across your path are actually learning journeys. You just don't really realize it. And that spun into a whole other avenue. And all of a sudden you have a book on your hands. Like, I don't know how that snowballed, but it actually did. And it happened. And then you have a book, which is insane.
Yeah. Yeah. And And I don't know whether it's possible to encourage people to embrace that opportunity, because I'd be a hypocrite to say that, because I don't think that that was necessarily the thought process. I think it was, I had pushed a boulder downhill,
yeah,
and I was still holding onto the boulder as it rolled downhill with me on it. Okay. If that makes sense.
It's like a funny image.
I don't think it ever occurred to me that I could say no. Right. I don't think it occurred to me that once I had started that path,
yeah,
that it was an option to say, yeah, never mind. I really didn't want to do this.
I'll pass.
I'm scared. Right. Yeah. And it was scary. I mean, and you know, one of the things, you know, whether it's blogging or writing books, that's often tough is just like blank page syndrome. Right. And I get trapped between two extremes. Like I get the blank page syndrome where you're staring at the blog editor, you're staring at you know, a Word doc that's got nothing in it. And like, where do I start? Right. And I am an indifferent outliner, if that's a way to describe it. I will on occasion outline, talks or you know, articles or blog posts or things that I want to do to kind of get my ideas organized.
Yeah.
But it isn't necessarily my natural way of doing things. I kind of naturally just flow and then edit.
Okay.
So for example, I'm in the midst of working on a blog post right now submitted a talk for a conference that I was entitling 5 Ways Home Automation Makes Me a Better Outsystems Developer.
Okay.
Right. So Outsystems is a low code platform that I've been working on for the past 5 years or so. I find that like low code and home automation have a lot of similarities. I've recently gotten into doing a lot of home automation with the open source Home Assistant software.
Okay.
If you think about like a low code flow, Home Assistant has this concept of automations.
Yeah.
A very similar concept, right? You need to go through a bunch of steps to accomplish a given end. And really, it's about differences in terms of how you represent those ideas, right? Yeah. You can represent that flow as code. You can represent that code in YAML, which is kind of Home Assistant's, one of Home Assistant's representations of how an automation will happen.
Yep.
You can represent it in a visual editor. There are some people who use Node-RED with Home Assistant. I've never quite gotten my head around Node-RED, but it's even more visual.
Okay.
You know, and on the OutSystem side, a flow is literally like a top to bottom visualization of logic.
Yeah.
Right. And when I first saw that, it's like, it totally clicked with me. So I wanted to kind of think through some of the ideas that popped into my head in terms of similarities between these worlds, and also encourage people, because you think about like developers often want to try out new languages, right? As a way of keeping their chops, like, okay, I want to try out Rust, or I want to try out Golang, or, you know, like, and they'll go through some tutorials, or they'll, you know, do like a 30 days of such and such language. And taking on home automation purely for the sense of learning is probably not something that anybody sane is going to do.
Yeah.
But like, if you're somebody who already has some Hue light bulbs in your house and you're using those and you like the idea of home automation, I think some of the concepts really mirror well. And there are just some things from the standpoint of, you know, troubleshooting.
Okay.
I'm learning a lot about UX, for example, by doing home automation, because a key piece for family acceptance is dashboards, right?
Okay.
How am I representing the things that my family wants to control or needs to control? And some of that, right, is actual literal physical switches, just like you'd have if you had normal lights, right? Because if the dashboard goes down and you can't turn the lights on and off, there's not a high acceptance factor in the family, right? That doesn't help a lot. But some of the things that it opens up for me in terms of even UI into an OutSystems application, like for example, we have a new, relatively new pet dog, never had a family dog before. But one of the things that we do is track, when has she been fed? When has she been out? When has she had a walk?
Yeah.
Right. And we used to do that on a paper log, and we would have stacks of paper, and we'd have to remember to print the next set of logs. It's, you know, pretty wasteful. It's a little time consuming. And so trying to get my teenagers to do that consistently was challenging. So what do I do as a geek? I wrote an OutSystems application that exposed a REST API that Home Assistant could call. And I wired up literal button, just like this one that I use to control my office lights.
Okay.
So that each direction is a particular activity. You click the button, it calls the REST API in the OutSystems application. And then the OutSystems application supplies a web page that I can iframe into my dashboard and see exactly what just last happened. And so if anybody in the family is dealing with the dog, we don't have to ask, when was Micah out last? Yeah. Right. We can go and look at the log. Okay. This is when she was fed. This is when, you know, yada, yada, and understand all of that. So it ends up being a good tool for facilitating communications, but it's also an exploration in, okay, how can I surface information in a way that is sufficiently dense, right? So I have an Amazon Fire tablet because it was cheap and I just stripped all the Amazon stuff out of it. Okay. And I've made it a permanent dashboard for the main, you know, for our kitchen, right? The hub of the hub of the house. And it's got all of the main lights that we use. It's got the thermostat. It's got the camera feeds from our garage, you know, from our two cameras in the house. And that's, you know, so it's basically providing both information and control in a single screen. So nobody other than me has to know how to navigate the different screens or dashboards of Home Assistant. We just leave that up. And, you know, my wife and one of my sons also has an app on their phone that they can use to control various things. But like, this is the primary interface for most of the things that we use.
Interesting.
And I'd say like one of the biggest struggles that I found early on, and this was pre Home Assistant, when we were still just doing Hue stuff, which I got into oddly enough because I'm relatively cheap. And so when I saw they had a huge deal on like the Hue light bulb starter kit, the hub and three bulbs at Costco, one of our US discount retailers. I mean, I think it was like basically like half the price of normal retail.
Okay.
And I think I bought like three at a time. I was like, this is a ridiculously cheap price. Yeah. I've wanted to get into this. So I'm jumping in with both.
There it is.
But the biggest challenge that I found with that was that when you're dealing with smart bulbs like that, you can't turn a lamp. Like if you put a smart bulb into a standard table lamp, you can't turn the lamp off with the switch. And socializing that with the family members was the initial really big challenge. Okay. And once we got over that hump, it wasn't too bad. But then it was like, you know, you have to go into the Hue app and whatnot. And so I got some of the dimmer switches so that instead of having to go into the app, you could just hit the dimmer switch.
Yeah.
Right. And it would turn on at the last thing that you had it on. Good to go. You know, the main thing I wanted smart bulbs for in the first place was at nighttime, just turn everything off at bedtime and not worry about whether somebody left the lights on or not.
Yeah, that's it. You know,
which is probably a pretty common first use case. But to get back to the blog post, like the thing about the blog post is that I started off with, you know, five headings. Like, okay, what are the five ways that I think, and of course, you know, being, you know, I wanted the kind of that clickbaity five, you know, five something something title. Doesn't have to be five.
Sure.
But so having committed myself to five, I had to come up with five of them. And so I did the headings first. But as I start writing, I realize, wow, this is going to be a really, really long blog post. And so I started thinking about, okay, does it make sense to do this as one long blog post? Are people going to have the attention span to read through this? Probably not. So now I'm kind of trying to think through, do I want to turn this into a series?
Yeah.
Right. Do I want to do five ways, way one as its own blog post? Right. or do I want to severely edit? And like, what's the absolute essence that I need to communicate for this particular way? Yep. Is there information that I've written here in my flow that's extraneous, or, you know, that doesn't really, you know, that isn't really necessary? And that editing process, that is one of the differences between blogging and writing for like a book or a magazine or something like that, is that in those latter processes, you typically have an external editor who's going to help serve that role. And in some cases they will aggravate you because they're imposing kind of their view on what is extraneous versus essential. And so, you know, there are times when you may have to push back and say, no, I really want this concept in there.
Yeah.
It's nice that you think that it's not essential, but no, I really want it in there. And then
are those editors technical as well? Or like technical oriented?
So typically it probably varies. I don't know what the state of the magazine world is anymore. Okay. I mean, I'm not even sure the extent to which paper magazines for programmers are really,
I don't think it's a big thing anymore.
Yeah. I think it's more online, and online, my sense is there's probably a little bit lighter,
okay,
if any editing, which is, I think that's a shame to an extent, because I think that relationship between a writer and an editor can help develop ideas, right?
Yeah.
Because
it's a form of co-creating.
Yeah, very much so. But also the other thing is that having an editor as kind of a partial external brain, if that makes sense, you know, having another perspective on, again, what is essential and what isn't, it can be very hard to discard one's own ideas.
Yeah.
Right. It can be very hard to invalidate things that you've come up with and created.
Yeah. You're invested.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like, I think some of the, you have an editor for your podcast, and I think that's awesome, because again, it's like that second set of eyes, that additional brain, and not just somebody who's outside of you, but somebody who's also likely done work with other creators.
Yeah.
And so they may have seen things that were successful that you haven't experienced, and be able to bring that perspective to the thing that you're creating and make it better.
Yeah.
Right. One of the things that was just an absolute revelation for me, I've done video stuff for a very long time. I did, you know, dozens of videos on Microsoft's Channel 9 over the years.
Okay.
You know, everything from short tutorial snippets to, you know, video podcast type episodes. A lot of my bread and butter was basic screencast stuff, where I wasn't even on camera. It's just literally throw Visual Studio or whatever I'm developing up on the screen, record the screen, record my audio, you know, very rough edit and push publish, right? Mm-hmm. Which has its place. And it's, you know, I mean, that the advantage of that is it's fairly low friction, right? So publish frequently, polish less, right?
Exactly.
It's like, I like polish, but if I'm responsible for the polish, it would be less likely that I get more content out, because the polish is not easy for me.
That's fair.
So when I was at OutSystems, I had the opportunity to work with the video team there, in particular, Miguel Marks, great video editor and motion graphics designer, and just really knew how to bring a level of polish and organization to the content that I was creating, and just took the content to an entirely different level.
Yeah.
I mean, just the right audio, the right transitions, the right edits and cuts just made all the difference in terms of, you know, feeling like, okay, I've created this screencast, right? And I'm not ashamed of my screencasts. I don't, but they weren't anything special.
Okay.
And having a team of of editors and people to kind of collaborate with and talk through what that content could look like. Yeah. Also kind of get creative about, hey, once we've made the decision for me to be on camera, like, A, I need a nicer camera, right? Yep. So I have a nice digital SLR. I've got a teleprompter on it because I will stumble if I don't, and I found that like I used to do scripts where I would have the script on screen in front of me. And so I'm looking over here instead of looking at the camera.
Yeah.
Right. And so if I'm doing content where it's a tutorial and I'm going to be on screen, I want to be looking at you, the audience,
exactly.
Not looking off here or just slightly off axis where it's like, what are you looking at? And why are your eyes moving back and forth in a really funny pattern?
Yeah.
So it's like some of those little details, they don't seem like a lot individually.
No, but
they can add
there.
Up to a really polished product that's more pleasant for people to consume. At least I think so.
Yeah.
And so having a team around you and being open to that kind of collaboration, as a writer, as an author, I don't always love working with editors because I don't always agree with the things that they suggest.
Yeah.
And there's that ego part that wants to say, no, I'm right.
Yeah.
Right.
This is mine.
I'm right and you're wrong.
Exactly.
And to the extent that you can lay that aside and embrace that collaboration, right, and embrace the possibility that maybe you're not actually always right. maybe you have a good idea that can be even better if you embrace what somebody else is telling you about what you're doing, right? It's, I'll jump back to Ultimate Frisbee for a bit. Like I was talking with some folks last night, like, my son and I were in a team over the winter, and I couldn't tell you how many games we won or lost.
Yeah.
I know we lost more games than we won. It was a fairly new team, but we had three people on the team who had never played Ultimate in their life. I think one of them may have never picked up a Frisbee before in his life.
Yeah.
And what they had going for them was that they wanted to learn, they were willing to listen, and put what they heard into practice.
Yeah.
They were coachable. And so I think as content creators, as developers, as whatever you're pursuing, if you can bring that spirit of coachability into it, you will find people around you who will embrace the role of helping you get better and being open to this idea of, of being coachable, of listening, of recognizing that you may not know everything, even if you've been around the block, opens things up so much more. And it also makes it super pleasant for the people around you because these three players were just a joy to be around because I could watch them both get more skilled, but also enjoy the game more as they got more skilled and more confident. And to watch that transition over a season, it's like that was the highlight of that team for me, not whether we had a winning or losing record.
Yeah.
And I'm a very competitive guy. I like to win. It's like I don't particularly like losing games, but the takeaway for me of that whole season was here are these three guys who came in with nothing and who embraced the challenge of learning this game and gave me the gift and my son the gift of being able to coach them and help them learn something fun and new.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, I want to be really I'm being very careful about how I say that because I'm not the best player in the world. I'm not the best coach in the world. I really feel like that was a gift that was given to me to be able to share that knowledge in that way. Right. They didn't get better because I'm a great coach. They got better because they were putting things into action and listening and being open to that coaching.
Yeah.
Which is pretty awesome.
I think being coachable in general, when you start out, you start off like that because you don't know a lot, right? So then you're like, okay, you come in with a certain amount of eagerness and curiosity, ask a lot of questions, and you get fulfillment for knowing new things or being able to do new things, right? Gaining those skills, and you get more confident.
Yeah.
But I think when you lose that, it's also a shame, right? Because then you feel like, okay, maybe I've grown to a certain point where I can't learn anymore. I feel like the art is to never lose that, to always stay humble, right? Be confident in what you know, but be open to feedback and knowledge of others. Because even if they're wrong and you're right, who cares, right? It's a different perspective. And maybe you'll know that for in the future, or maybe you'll know what feedback to give or what advice to give, right? It's still a learning. Because I feel like once you close yourself off to those opportunities, you also lose a sense of fulfillment with that. And I like that you said it's a gift towards you as well, right? It's a gift all around. And the best wins are the win-wins, which is exactly that case.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the things is like, so I think back to like the analogy of pushing a boulder down the hill and rolling down with it, right? With the book. I think one of the things when I was early in my career is I didn't know what I didn't know, right? So there was an aspect of fear and terror of, oh gosh, I have to write a book and I know I don't know enough.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't think I knew the scale of what I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was an openness and a willingness to embrace the challenge because I didn't fully appreciate how big that gulf was.
Yeah.
Right. And it turns out that I was able to bridge that gulf, right? That I had the capacity to learn as I went and put together enough knowledge to be useful to someone.
Yeah.
Right. And that, I mean, at the end of the day, that's what success looks like. Were people able to learn from my book? Yes. Was it the best book that someone could have written on Visual InterDev 6 as an enterprise development tool? No. Right. Like, let's be real. A guy who has less than 5 years in as a software developer is not going to write the very best enterprise development book on InterDev 6. That's not going to happen in any universe. Was it good enough for people to learn from? Yes.
Yeah.
Was it the right decision for me to write it? Yes. Right. Fast forward 20 years. I know how much I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that causes hesitancy.
Okay.
And that gets back to exactly what you were talking about, right? That openness, that willingness to embrace and learn. But it's not just I know everything and I have nothing left to learn. There's also the flip side of it, which is I recognize how much I don't know.
Yeah.
And that can be paralyzing. Mm. And it's really...
But why is that paralyzing then? Because is it, it's you that's making it paralyzing, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an internal thing for sure. Right. It's just that I think that it's easy to, and again, I should couch it as speaking for myself. Right. Mm. I think that younger Andrew found it easier to jump in with both feet and do stuff.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know how much I didn't know.
Okay.
Knowing how much I don't know feels like, well, I don't have the authority to say that, or I don't have the authority to speak into that, which is sort of absurd because I have 20 years of experience, right? If you would think that 20 years of experience would tell my ego, yes, you have all the authority. But there's a difference between being recognized as people know that I know a lot about OutSystems. People know that I know a lot about .NET, and that's that's fine. That's an external recognition that doesn't necessarily conform to the internal experience of where my head, where my head is at.
Yeah.
I think that there's a definite positive aspect because if I'm a little insecure occasionally, hopefully that will keep me from being arrogant.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that it's healthy to recognize that there's a lot that you don't know. I'm just calling out the, you know, the potential paralysis, because like, I know a lot of, you know, and there's been a lot of discussion over the years about imposter syndrome, right? Mm. And that's something that I, you know, have constantly struggled with.
Yeah.
In part because I'm not a formally trained software developer. I don't have a CS degree, right? I didn't go through that particular path. You know, while I've had a lot of training over the years, you know, I don't have a lot of formal education in terms of software development. I don't have a lot of formal education in terms of electronics. Mm. I find stuff that I like and I get into it and I start learning it, right?
And there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
No, not at all. But psychologically, I think that it opens up the possibility of not feeling like you're real,
yeah.
Not feeling like you ever quite can consider yourself authoritative in those areas, you know, because there's always going to be a gap. And you know, again, I'll relate it back to Ultimate. I mean, I spent probably longer than I should have feeling less than adequate as an Ultimate player,
okay.
Because I am older, I'm slower, and a lot of the folks that I play with are in their, you know, 20s and early 30s, right? Although they're even on my team, I've got a guy who's 5 years older than me who's an absolute inspiration.
Awesome.
You know, buff as all hell. And like, I just want to train with the dude because it's like, dang, he's in good shape.
Yeah.
But, you know, I made the mistake of comparing myself to these people who had been playing Ultimate a lot longer than I had and who are younger and more fit than I am, and getting discouraged by that. Mm. And I realized, like, hold on, this is just not the right perspective, right?
Yeah.
I need to be comparing myself to how I did last game.
Exactly.
Or how I did last season. And when I look at it from that perspective, it's like I can look back and see the growth and recognize that, you know, it's like I'm doing better than I did, you know, when I started. I'm doing better than I did last year.
Yeah.
I'm having more fun. I'm more deeply involved. I'm helping organize a team, helping organize a league, you know, and helping bring other people into a sport that, you know, that brings me and brings others, you know, fun and joy. You know, so I don't have to be the best for it to be valuable.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that the same thing can kind of apply, you know, in the tech world and in, you know, in being a content creator is to not worry about whether you know what everybody else knows.
Yeah.
Because I think the flaw in imposter syndrome is that we end up, we look at other people who we admire or who we look up to, and we think, well, they know everything, right? Which is the first lie of imposter syndrome, is they know everything, right? And I only know this tiny little thing.
Yeah.
Right? And what we don't see is the vast number of things that they don't know that we do.
Exactly.
Right? And that's why, again, getting back to content creation, why, yeah, my personal take is anybody who wants to create content should create content. Because you will always have something that you know that somebody else doesn't, and they can learn from you.
Exactly.
Right? Anybody out there who's feeling imposter syndrome in any way, shape, or form, let me say this very clearly. You know something that somebody else doesn't know, and they don't know everything. Exactly. I don't know everything. Patrick doesn't know everything. Like, we don't know everything. There's lots and lots of stuff that we don't know, and we still need to learn.
Yeah.
Or that we may never learn, right? You know, at the end of the day, there's only so many things that you can, you know, gain expertise in. And it's okay to not know those things that you don't care about that much.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Because I feel like if people are open with that and transparent, you can't be an authority on everything. You can't know everything either. If something pops up and you honestly say, well, I actually don't know this, or maybe this is my perspective, but I'm not quite sure, then who cares if you're right or wrong, right? That is not the essence here. And together you'll figure it out, because usually you're not by yourself anyway. But
right.
That allows people to be like, okay, they don't know, I don't know, we'll figure it out, right? Yeah. You can have the confidence of figuring it out instead of relying on this kind of image of someone, which is not true, that image that knows everything. Because that's, I mean, you're never going to achieve that yourself anyways. So then you're always stuck with this feeling of not being adequate enough or not holding yourself up to a certain bar that you've set for yourself. But yeah. I feel like it's all your inner perspective, right? I feel like if you can just let go of things, being transparent and honest about what you know and what you don't know, still be humble about the things that you know, I think that shift right. in perspective and mindset is going to bring you further than holding on to those feelings of, I need to know everything and I don't know and I feel like I'm behind. Because yeah. that's not a good feeling to move from and to learn from.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite takes on humility, and I'm blanking on who the originator of the quote is, but that humility is not thinking of yourself, not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. And and one of the things that's kind of core to the conversation we're having is that a lot of this stuff is based on being inside your own head.
Yeah.
And one of the advantages of, you know, community involvement, whether that's helping organize events, whether that's speaking at user groups or things like that, one of the upsides of being involved in communities like that is that it's other focused, right? And that can help you get out of your head and not have it be so much about, am I good enough, but I want to help people.
Yeah.
Right. If you're doing things for the people out there, you've got less time and energy to be up here in your head worrying about, oh, am I good enough? Am I, you know, do I know enough to do this? It's like, no, don't worry about whether you know enough. Just go help people.
Yeah.
Just go share. Go
do
talk.
The best thing you can do. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I like that. I'm going to round it off here, Andrew, because I've been hearing some drilling, but I don't think it's being picked up by the mic. I hope it's not.
I heard it a little bit a couple of times, but
yeah, exactly. I'm gonna have to see how much of that came through. Like,
it wasn't a very long stretch.
It's the first time this has happened. Actually, like, man, maybe we should check if there's gonna be some drilling on the floor above us, I guess. But thank you so much for coming on and sharing. I'm gonna put all Andrew's socials in the description below. Check him out. Sweet. Let him know you came from our show. And with that being said, thank you so much for coming on again, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
We'll see you on the next one. Thanks for listening.